Hello, my friends, and welcome to the Seeds and Weeds Podcast, brought to you by Small House Farm. Join us as we talk with gardeners, foragers, herbalists, chefs, and community activists to explore the many ways that plants impact our cultures and cuisines, our history, and our future. I'm your host, Bevan Cohen, and this is Seeds and Weeds. Howdy, friends. Welcome back to Seeds and Weeds. Today, we're going to be sitting down with Shubber Ali, the founder of Garden for Wildlife, to talk about growing native plants, how native plants support your ecosystem, and what you can do to create a little wildlife sanctuary right in your own backyard. It's a great interview, so you're definitely going to want to stick around for that. I mentioned in our last episode that I was going to be on the Pantry Chat podcast with Carolyn Thomas to talk about that new GMO purple tomato. Well, that interview just recently dropped, and you can find the link to listen down in the show notes if you want to go check it out. Here at Small House, we've been busy planting seeds. Our peppers, they're already up, along with a number of different brassicas, herbs, and flowers. I gotta tell you, it is so nice having baby plants in the house again. Even though, while I'm recording this, there's still snow on the ground, there's a lot of plants starting to reappear out in the garden, too. The arugula is starting to pop up. The Egyptian walking onions, they're back in full force. And I just love being able to go out and, you know, gather some fresh green onions every day. That's totally awesome. Another plant that's making a spring comeback is the leaf turnip that we grew last year. Now, this is an Italian variety. It's essentially a turnip, but instead of making an actual bulb underground, it produces an abundance of tasty leaves. And it's a biennial, so the plants to survive the winter, it should be ready to flower and make some seeds for us this spring. Of course, if all goes well and we get a good harvest, we'll be listing those seeds on our website so you can grow this groovy and delicious plant too. You can find the link to our seed shop down in the show notes or smallhousefarm.com/seeds. It's also about time for the wild food plants to be popping up here in Michigan. Now, if you live in a warmer climate, you might already be enjoying some of these tasty delicacies, you know, things like ramps and morel mushrooms. In our next episode, we're actually going to have author and forager George Barnett on the show. We're going to be talking about all sorts of delicious wild foods. And I'm really looking forward to sharing that conversation with you. It's just packed full of cool information. In the most recent issue of Mother Earth News Magazine, there's an article from Erin Hamilton about growing morel mushrooms right at home. And you might remember Erin when she was on the show to talk about cultivating mushrooms. She's an expert in the world of fungi, right? And her article in Mother Earth News is just absolutely fascinating. Morel mushrooms, they could be pretty elusive in the wild, right? So imagine being able to grow them right in your own garden. Sounds pretty cool. I'm going to share a link for the article, of course, down in the show notes, like always. But I'm also going to drop a link to Erin's interview from when she was here on the podcast, just in case you haven't had an opportunity to check it out yet. Today's episode of the podcast is brought to you by our amazing community on Patreon. The support of our Patreon community is what allows us to keep offering this program. So big thanks to all of our community members, as well as our newest members, Jill Ahern and Pamela Satina. Welcome to the community, my friends. Remember, you can join our Patreon community and support the Seeds and Weeds podcast for as little as $3 a month. Membership perks include things like free heirloom seeds, seasonal gift baskets, and access to our special herb co-op. You can find more information at the link in the show notes or directly at patreon.com/smallhousefarm. Shubber Ali is the CEO of Garden for Wildlife, a program that began within the National Wildlife Federation. Garden for Wildlife allows people to make a difference for the environment by shipping plants native to their zip code to support local wildlife. Shubber is incredibly passionate about innovation, nature, and wildlife, and is on a mission to get as many people as possible to help save the planet yard by yard. Last year, Garden for Wildlife shipped 62,000 plants across 38 states and 2,900 cities here in America. Today, Shubber's joining us on the show to talk about Garden for Wildlife and the importance of native plants. Shubber Ali, welcome to the show, my friend. I'm super excited to have you with us here today.
It is a pleasure to be here. Thank you so much for having me, Bevan.
Now, you're here to talk about the Garden for Wildlife program, but before we get into that, could you just get our listeners up to speed with a little bit about who you are, maybe your background and some of the work that you do?
You know, this is probably the weirdest career I've ever had of my many careers. I've spent the last 30 years mostly in big consulting, helping Fortune 500 companies in innovation work and strategy, and then a little bit in software at places like Salesforce, where I was a VP of innovation many years ago. And then I've done a number of startup companies, some of which have been successful and some of which were what we call great learning experiences, which is just code word for they failed. But and then I've also taught at a university on the side. So as my mom says, I can't seem to hold a single job, but I've done lots of different things. But this plant business is a whole different world for me.
Are you a home gardener as well?
Yeah, actually, that's part of how this whole thing came about. I've been a gardener. Vegetables is where I started, really, probably about 25 years ago as a hobby. And then after I grew my first tomato, just to see what it was like back when I lived in D.C. many, many years ago, and tasted it and realized what actual homegrown vegetables taste like, I was like, I can never go and buy like a store-bought one again. And so after that, I got started on my little journey of growing vegetables. And then a few years later, I got into growing plants for birds and butterflies and things like that. And so I was doing that for, oh, I don't know, since probably the early 2000s. And well, I'll come back to the story as how that led to Garden for Wildlife, but that's my long answer to your short question.
I love it. So let's start at the very beginning of this. Garden for Wildlife is a program that was originally launched through the National Wildlife Foundation. Could you just tell our listeners what the National Wildlife Foundation is?
Yeah, so it's the National Wildlife Federation, as I've come to learn. So they're actually one of the largest and oldest not-for-profits in the U.S. focused on the environment. It was actually started by an interesting gathering of hunters, anglers, and environmentalists, which if you think about that, that's especially in this day and age, not necessarily the obvious group you get together in one place, but they wanted to protect our wild spaces. Fast forward to the 1970s, and in 1973, they launched a program called Garden for Wildlife, which is really meant to be primarily an educational program to help people understand the importance of gardening to support the bees, butterflies, birds, and other wildlife in your own backyard or front yard. They also launched a program at the same time called Certify Wildlife Habitats, which made it easy for you to certify your own yard as a place that was wildlife friendly. And so that meant, you know, in the case of like birds, for instance, two sources of food, some source of water, could be a bird bath or a pond or what have you, and then also shelter and a place to raise young. And if you did that, you could get a certification. In the last 50 years since the program launched, almost 51 years now, they've certified almost 300,000 properties, mostly homes, but also over 10,000 schoolyards and then a number of corporate locations as well. So fast forward to roughly late 2019, my family and I moved from the Bay Area to Maryland, where we are now. And we were fortunate enough, we got this house with a big, large lawn in the front, which is about 2 acres, and it's lawn. And the first thing I thought was, well, let me go put in gardens because I've been a gardener. At that time, a book had just come out from a professor at the University of Delaware, Doug Tallamy, who is a scientific advisor to the National Wildlife Federation, and is actually now a scientific advisor to Garden for Wildlife, the company. And I read his book, which had come out. I highly recommend it to anybody listening to this podcast. It's called Nature's Best Hope. And it was like a moment that I described to people who are either old enough like me that they remember this, or young enough now because they're hip again with records, that they also recognize this sound. But it's that sound of the needle being suddenly dragged across the record, because that zzz moment was when, in reading his book, I realized that what I've been doing for over 20 years in gardening was not only not actually helping the environment, it was hurting. And as somebody who's been a supporter of NWF since the mid 90s, that was a jarring moment for me. So of course, what did I discover was that when we plant these plants that you buy at the big box stores, you think of like, you know, Lowe's, Home Depot, Walmart, et cetera, garden centers that you can get plants from, the vast majority of them are actually invasive species from other parts of the world. And the problem with them is that they are not actually evolved to be where we are. And therefore, the wildlife that's evolved to coexist with them, think in particular like butterflies and moths, and then the birds that rely on the caterpillars from those butterflies and moths, all started disappearing because we've been wiping out native plants. Everybody knows about the monarch. It's the most extreme example. The caterpillars can only feed on one specific plant, the milkweed, and a specific species of milkweed, depending on where you live. But it's actually a much bigger problem across the board. And so I set out to find native plants. I went back to Lowe's and I Googled every single plant in the store. I kid you not, like literally picked up every single plant. And after 3 hours, discovered not a single plant was native. So I thought, okay, well, where do I get native plants from? And when I started searching for them, I realized how hard it was to find native plants in my area. And that's when I reached out. I was at the time a partner at Accenture in innovation. And so I had the luxury of being able to do pro bono work with clients, like not-for-profits. So I reached out to National Wildlife Federation and said, I want to do a project with you to solve my problem, but I think it's a problem many gardeners in the U.S. face. And that problem is not just getting plants. It starts with awareness and then education and then access. So awareness is you have to know that you need native plants, and that's why birds and butterflies and moths and things have been disappearing. Then you need to know specifically what plants are native to you. Well, NWF actually had built with Professor Tallamy about, I think, 15 years ago, this amazing database called the Native Plant Finder. And they actually have every single tree and shrub and native perennial in the U.S. at the zip code level. So they did the hard part of figuring out what goes where. So we took that as the basis for what Garden for Wildlife, the platform platform has. And that was the last piece, but you had to be able to buy the stuff. And so we wrote a business plan for NWF that said, create an e-commerce site. And this was just as the pandemic was starting. So it's perfect timing because nobody was going anywhere, and make it easy for people to get native plants delivered right to their doorstep. So they can just go to the site, search by zip code, find the plants specifically to them, beautiful flowers of different kinds, because it started with perennials. So you can sort by color, by height, by season of bloom, by type of soil, by amount of light, all kinds of things. Then order the plants and they show up on your doorstep. And all you have to do is dig a hole and stick them in the ground. And they kind of do the rest on their own because they're native, right? They know how to live there. You don't have to fertilize. You don't have to use pesticides on them or do anything else. So we launched that business inside of NWF in 2021. And about a year later, I went back to them and said, this is actually much bigger than I think we realized. The opportunity here is huge, but not if it's run inside of the not-for-profit, because you're a not-for-profit and there's a lot of limitations that come with being a large not-for-profit, including what you can pay people and the fact you can't give them equity and hiring the right talent to scale this as an e-commerce business. You need to take this and spin it out as a for-profit company where you're the biggest shareholder, but then you can bring in outside investors. And so they agreed and asked me to be the CEO. So I quit my perfectly good job and joined the plant business world and have been doing it for about 17 months now. And it's amazing. I've learned so much. I've been able to surround myself with fantastic people. And what we do is we make it easy for people to buy native plants.
This is wonderful. I got a lot to unpack from what you just said there. So first I want to say I went through the website, I browsed it. I was shopping around for plants, and it is so user-friendly. Like you were saying, I can choose what kind of garden I want. If I'm looking for particular colors of flowers, how much sun do I have? It really was a customizable experience to get me the exact plants that are going to thrive for me, exactly what I need and want in my area. It's really, really so well done.
Thank you.
So when folks order plants off of the website and they get shipped, do they come with any sort of growing instructions or tips and tricks to help these folks get these plants established and help them thrive?
Absolutely. So we do a couple of different things. One is we have digital planting guides for everything we sell. So we sell things like collections as well that have been designed by horticulturalists that have multiple species in the same collection because they serve a bigger purpose. So for instance, for monarchs, you have milkweed, but you also have in the monarch munchable collection, which is one of them. You also have two other species. So you have blooming across multiple seasons, which gives them food when they're adults as well. But they come with planting guides that show you exactly how you can lay them out, and also care guides. And we have a whole community we're building around that to help people like ask questions and come back. You know, we have a Facebook page with 450,000 followers, for instance, and we do have lots of ways of engaging with it. One of the great things about native plants, though, is, and they're perennial, they know what to do where they are because that's what they're meant to be. So unlike if you have gardeners who are used to having to like put in plants and then fertilize them and do all these other things, take care of them. One of the things that's really cool about native plants is a saying that I learned that they sleep, creep, and leap. So you'll put them in the ground and at first they don't seem like they're doing much. The reason why is that they're busy building root systems that in some cases go down as much as 15 feet. Why that's good is it actually opens up the soil. So it uncompacts it from what might've been sod or something before, which allows water to drain in it better, beneficial insects to grow in there, all kinds of great things. And also of course, sequester carbon. But then the next year and every year after that, they leap, they bloom. And if I could show you photos of my own yard, this is how I discovered it, is I dug an area out in my lawn, put in some native plants. I was the very first customer of Garden for Wildlife. And those plants now, the black-eyed Susans, the little blue stem grasses, the purple coneflowers, all of them are amazing every year when they come back. And then of course we have a 1-year guarantee. So if anything happens with your plant, we'll just ship a new one.
All right, let's go back to your experience at Lowe's when you were Googling all the different plants and discovering that they did not offer anything in their whole shop that was native. And then what you had said about how native plants do so well because they're in their home, they're where they're supposed to be. So they require less maintenance and care. So how did it happen? I don't know if you can answer this question specifically, but maybe speculate. How did it happen that suddenly all of these stores were offering all of these exotic plants from far away that don't even really do that well when they could have just been offering native plants from the get-go?
Well, so it's a combination of factors. One of the simplest is think capitalism, right? The garden centers don't actually really own the plants when they get there. In many cases, what happens is they pay for them when they're scanned at purchase. So there's a whole value chain that I discovered about the plant industry. You have growers who grow plants. You then have finishers who take them from them and get them ready for shipment, then distributors, and ultimately to retailers, and then to the consumers. And what they're trying to do is sell things that, one, the average gardener doesn't necessarily know the importance of native or non-native is. They're just looking for colorful, showy things they can put in the ground in the spring. And so that's what they've catered to that market. But then there became this whole thing about creating branded plants, right? And you'll see this with a number of big growers out there, is that they create things that they can trademark or patent, or, you know, a specific color or twist or give it a name, you know, that is a marketing thing, right? And as a result, they're able to push that kind of stuff in there. But, you know, it's kind of like the junk food of plants.
Oh, that's a really good way to put it. Huh. Now, I know that you've already touched on this, but let's, I want to really hammer this point home for the listeners. Can you give us the list again of the reasons why native plants are so important for us to grow?
Yeah, and I'll give you my example, because it's one of my favorite examples in the book that Professor Tellamy wrote, which is he said, you know, if you take a single nest of chickadees, right, which is, well, I don't know, five or six little baby birds, and from the time they hatch to the time they leave the nest, how many caterpillars do you think one nest of chickadees eats on average? From the time they hatch all the way until the time they leave the nest?
I don't know. Let's say 50. I don't know.
Okay. It's somewhere between 6,000 and 9,000.
Oh my gosh.
Yeah. So now you can understand why over the last few decades, 3 billion pairs of nesting songbirds have disappeared from our country. The reason why you see less of all those beautiful birds that you would hear in the morning, which we'll come back to why that's important from a health perspective, have disappeared because the food source for their babies has disappeared. And so just like we can't feed baby, like 6-month-olds, steak, right? They need baby food. For the baby birds, they need soft proteins. So while like I have plenty of bird feeders in my backyard and lots of people love putting bird feeders out and there's like whole industry around feeding birds, they can't feed those seeds back to their baby birds. They need soft proteins. And the primary source of that is things like caterpillars. The caterpillars disappear because we rip out the native species, not just the perennial flowers, but the shrubs and ultimately the keystone trees. And when you take those out and replace them with these gigantic sterile lawns that might look really nice as a manicured estate or whatever, but they serve no purpose biologically, you can see how the food chain breaks down. And ultimately, we should care not just because the birds are disappearing, but because when the pollinators disappear, there's a great photo, your listeners can find it on Google, of what a supermarket produce section looks like if we didn't have pollinators. And basically 80% of the fruits and vegetables that are out there would disappear. So people should care. They should care that we are wiping out the things that are really important to our survival. Professor Wilson from Harvard, E.O. Wilson, is probably one of the preeminent biologists out there. He once said, if humans disappeared in 10,000 years, you wouldn't even know we were here. But if insects disappear in 100 years, we'd all be screwed. Because he was much more eloquent than that, but that's essentially what he said. That's a real problem. And so there are lots of beneficial insects out there. And a lot of your listeners may know about the honeybee. Well, the honeybee is actually European. That's not the one that we should worry about. There's actually about 400 species of native bees in the U.S. And many of them are in danger because we have pesticided and wiped out native plants and put in all these sterile lawns and done all these things combined. That's a big problem.
It's humbling to think about that just a few small plants in my backyard, as opposed to a lawn of grass, could have such an impact that follows a chain all the way back to my own grocery store.
Yeah. And, you know, it's funny because that's what we tell people is just take a small section. You don't have to rip out your lawn. We're not saying that. If you just take a small section of the corner of your yard, like a 4-foot by 6-foot section, and put in some native plants, I guarantee in 1 year you will notice a difference. Because not only did I do it myself, so I am the test customer here, and I really... like, it's amazing the things that are showing up. Like, turtles moved into this pond that I dug, and then frogs showed up. I don't know how they got there, right? But all these things started showing up. And now we have this whole oasis in our yard. But a good friend of mine who lives in Chicago, inside the loop, so inner city Chicago, I told him last spring, I said, you need to get a pot, put it on your balcony, like a deep pot, and then I'll send you some plants. He's like, I'm not going to get anything. I live in Chicago in the city. And I said, trust me, you will. A month after he planted his plants, he texted me one morning. He's like, oh my God, there's a monarch on my balcony. Nature is incredibly resilient, but we have to like help it just a tiny bit and it will make a huge difference.
Yeah, that's amazing. So it's got to be quite a task to organize all of the different growers and distributors to be able to have all these plants and to get them all these places. How's that working for you?
It's actually working really well. We've really focused on trying to add lots of smaller like family growers because we want to support small business as well. And actually, it's the whole focus area for Garden for Wildlife is to build a network of small businesses that are helping to restore the habitat, the environment by growing native plants. There are lots of them out there and we become kind of that fulfillment arm. So part of my vision is that ultimately we will have growers in every single state supporting the market in that state, which also shortens the supply chain, lowers the impact of transportation, all the other pieces that go with it. The other piece that lets us do is we launched, I don't know if you're familiar with, you probably are, companies like Bombas, the sock company, where they have these programs where for every pair of socks they sell, they donate a pair to the homeless people, right? So they have this buy one, give one. And Warby Parker does it with eyeglasses and Tom's Shoes does it with shoes. And we copied that model when I got here and said, we're going to donate native plants for every plant we sell. And so, of course, that means we have to have twice as much capacity. So we're growing our network. But one of the things we did is when we started that last summer, you know, we've planted over 80 gardens across the country now. We don't literally donate a plant for a plant. What we do is we set aside like 400 and do a big planting like we did in our very first one in East Baltimore or up. Actually, we did one in, I think it's called Marygrove Gardens up in Detroit.
I saw pictures of it. Yep.
Yeah. So we do these all over the country and those are free. And, you know, it's just for places that historically might not have gotten access to native plants and gardens and you know, shrubs and things like that, because it serves multiple purposes. Because ultimately, one of the things that's really important as well is we've lost the connection between our own physical and mental health and nature, right? And it's proven, the scientists have actually documented this for decades. Being exposed to nature actually improves your physical health as well as your mental well-being. So what we're trying to do is help to bring that back.
I'd seen on the website, and I think you might've mentioned this as well, that there's a place where folks can apply to have their garden certified as a wildlife habitat. Could you tell us a little bit more about that program?
Yeah, it's actually a really easy thing to do. My yard's certified. I have a big sign out front for my neighbors to all ask me questions about. It's through the National Wildlife Federation, which is our biggest shareholder and what we kind of came out of. And the program, the Certified Wildlife Habitat Program, there's really four key criteria. The first one is you have to have two sources of food. So for instance, if you have a bird feeder and you also have seed-bearing flowers or berry-bearing bushes, that kind of thing in your garden, the native ones, that counts. A source of water, which can, again, be a bird bath or it can be a pond or something of that nature. Then you need to have some sort of shelter or place. So think of shrubs where birds can hide inside of them to get away from larger predators. And then finally, a place to raise young. So I have birdhouses that put up around my yard. You do those things and you can actually, with a simple application form, and I think it's like a $20 application fee, certify your yard. And then there's a number of different signs you can order and put up. And it says this property is a certified wildlife habitat. And we're actually starting to see it now with real estate agents putting it in listings here in Virginia and Maryland. If they are certified habitats, because it actually is proving to be attractive to people looking by a home. Maybe they have young kids and they want them to know that they're going to see butterflies and birds and stuff like that, or if they're environmentally minded or what have you.
So what advice do you have for novice gardeners or maybe folks with small spaces that are looking to try growing some native plants for the first time?
Just start. Really just start and trust the process, but give it a year, because again, the first year they're going to spend most of their time building root structures, which is how they become really successful in years 2, 3, 4, 5, and 6. And what that also means is you don't have to buy plants every year, which is great because perennials are actually cheaper than annuals, but people don't do that math. They walk in, they're like, oh, this plant's $3 and this plant's $9. I'll buy the $3 plant. Yes, but you have to buy it every year and then you have to dig a hole for it every year and plant it and fertilize it. And it all adds up. Whereas the other one just comes back and it comes back bigger and better every year. So there's that as well, you know, save your time and save your money, you know. And then the only thing you have to do is, you know, in the fall, when people oftentimes will cut down plants, this is another piece that I learned, is that oftentimes if they got larger stems, leave them be all winter long. In fact, we had a thing this winter where we had customers sending us in pictures. We called it Beauty Beyond Blooms, which is pictures of their dead plants still there all winter, because things like bees will actually overwinter in the stems. They'll actually go inside and they'll basically sleep in there and stay protected from the weather. And then in the spring, you can cut them down. It's just like we say, you know, don't pick up your leaves in the fall, because it actually creates ground cover for all kinds of beneficial insects and other things that need that protection over the lawn.
So you're not being lazy, you're actually providing habitat.
That's what I always tell my neighbors. I'm like, I'm not raking my lawn because it's good for the environment.
That's awesome. Shubber, what are the links that folks are going to need so they can learn more about Garden for Wildlife?
Just go to gardenforwildlife.com and we have a wealth of resources there. The last thing I'll say is if any of your listeners are involved in a not-for-profit, it can be a PTA or a scout troop or anything else, we have a whole fundraising platform where we, it's like an affiliate program. You can sign up and then whenever people buy native plants from anywhere in the country that you send the link to, your group will get a share of the revenue.
Awesome. And I'm going to make sure to put that link down in the show notes for everybody so they can click right on through. Thank you again so much for taking the time to sit down with us today. That was a ton of fun.
Bevan, it was a pleasure. Thanks so much for having me.
And that brings us to the end of another episode. Thanks again to Shubber Ali for being our guest and to all of you for tuning in. Remember, if you enjoy the show and would like to support our work, you can always join our Patreon community. You can find that link and many more at seedsandweedspodcast.com. This episode was edited and produced by all of us here at Small House Farm. And the music you're enjoying right now is Gypsy Swing by Sergey Quadrado. Thanks again for tuning in, friend. I'm Bevan Cohen, and we'll see you next time.
Yeah.
Howdy, friends. Bevan here. You know, the Seeds and Weeds podcast is made possible in part by Baker Creek Heirloom Seed Company, rareseeds.com. They're America's top source for rare and heirloom varieties from around the world, and they're publisher of the whole seed catalog. Their 2024 catalog is chocked full of heirloom goodness, new varieties, recipes, stories, and gorgeous photographs. You can order yours now at rareseeds.com.